44,200 since October 2023. Hello and welcome to your world news. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has once again condemned the Israeli crimes in Lebanon and Palestine, saying Israel is a fool to think bombing civilian structures amounts to victory. Ayatollah Khamenei added that Israel has been committing war crimes in Gaza and Lebanon rather than achieving victory. The leader pointed to the arrest warrant issued for the Israeli premier by the International Criminal Court. He said this is not enough and instead called for the issuance of a death sentence for Benjamin Netanyahu. Ayatollah Khamenei also noted that the Zionist enemy is only strengthening the resistance front by committing crimes against the Palestinians and the Lebanese. The leader made the comments in a meeting with hundreds of members of the Siege Volunteer Forces on the anniversary of its establishment. Ayatollah Khamenei praised Basij as a key element against hegemonic powers' plots against Iran. Well, earlier, Giso Misha Ahmadi elaborated on the remarks by Iran's Islamic Revolution leader. Let's take a listen.
Probably the most significant part of the leader's address today was pointing to the arrest warrant that has been issued for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as it was about time, and of course not enough. In the leader's words, there should be a death sentence for the war crimes, crimes against humanity, the genocide that is going on for more than a year in Gaza, and now it has extended to Lebanon. And it is quite clear that the Israeli regime will not be stopping there. And that is why the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution took the opportunity to point that out today, emphasizing that an arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu is not enough. There should be a death sentence.
Fresh Israeli airstrikes target more residential areas across Lebanon as the regime's aggression against the Arab country continues unabated. Residential buildings were damaged after two separate attacks targeted several neighborhoods in Beirut's southern suburb of Dahiya. Lebanon's southern regions have also come under fire as Israel's artillery shelling and airstrikes targeted several towns and villages across Nabatiya governorate. Earlier, 15 houses were destroyed in the town of Yamer Ash'if. Meanwhile, the Israeli military has issued evacuation orders ahead of its imminent air raid on the southeastern village of Halta. Since October last year, Israeli attacks on Lebanon have claimed over 3,750 civilian lives and left more than 15,600 others injured. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has carried out fresh retaliatory operations against Israel, setting off sirens across the northern occupied territories. Israeli media reported that around 20 missiles were fired towards Nahariya and several other and southern Israeli settlements in western Galilee. The attack has resulted in injuries, with at least one individual reported wounded in Nahariya. Hezbollah earlier carried out large-scale missile and drone strikes against the regime, causing damage across the occupied territories and wounding at least 11 people. Israeli media said on Sunday that 340 missiles were launched from Lebanon in one of the biggest Hezbollah attacks. Hezbollah has carried out drone and missile attacks in retaliation for Israel's invasion of Lebanon and its assault on Gaza. Additionally, its fighters have been engaged in combat with Israeli occupation forces in southern Lebanon. The director of Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza has written a letter urging the world to take action to stop Israel's, quote, genuine campaign of extermination in the region. Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, who was injured in an Israeli attack, has stated in the letter that the Israeli military is using a new weapon, which bombs with tiny fragments that penetrate the bodies of the victims, leading to severe bleeding and damage to internal organs. He said that the remaining staff at the hospital are committed to providing care and fulfilling their humanitarian duty in spite of the atrocities committed by Israeli forces against them. The Kamal Adwan Hospital has been under direct Israeli attack for 7 days. Aside from the constant attacks, northern Gaza has been under a complete siege for 50 days, where Israeli forces are blocking the entry of food, water, and medicine. The United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees says around 500,000 people in Gaza could be flooded with sewage once winter rains begin. The UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge made the comment to the Financial Times. She also stated that malnourished people will get sicker due to this development. Waterridge asserted that the Israeli regime is hindering the entry of aid into the besieged strip. Air trucks remain at the Rafah crossing due to the Israeli restrictions. At this rate, she says, it will take 2 years to get the basic necessities to everyone. Meanwhile, the NGO Save the Children says that about 130,000 children under 10 are trapped in conditions not fit for survival in northern Gaza. The organization called for global intervention and the immediate entry of food, water, and medical supplies to reach the, quote, death zone. More death and destruction across the Gaza Strip as the Israeli regime presses ahead with its genocidal war. The death toll among Palestinians has surpassed 44,200 since October last year. This is while more than 104,000 others have been injured. Our Gaza correspondent Muti Abu Musabeh had joined us earlier to give us the latest on the Israeli aggression. Let's go and take a listen.
Let me begin with the middle area of Gaza Strip, where the Israeli warplanes over the last night targeted and destroyed a mosque in the northern part of an Nusra refugee camp. In addition to that, several residential buildings were targeted and destroyed as well in Beit Lahia, Syria, and Jabalia refugee camps. Those areas were completely targeted by the Israeli artillery shelling over the last night. And in Rafah City, in the southern part of Gaza Strip, the Israeli warplanes over the last couple of hours carried out another airstrike against a gathering of the Palestinian people in Musabbih area in the northern part of Rafah City, killing two Palestinian civilians and injuring two others. Last night, it was raining cats and dogs in all areas of Gaza Strip. This means that Palestinian people taking shelter in their worn-out makeshift tents actually were flooded. The last night was horrific for the Palestinian people, and particularly for those who are still living by the sea and in the areas adjacent to the sea, because according to multiple eyewitnesses, that many makeshift tents were completely engulfed and flooded by the water waves and the sea waves. According to them, they have recovered their children in the last moments after they were completely, as you know, engulfed by the sea waves. So the people are literally trapped between the constant Israeli airstrikes and attacks and the catastrophic humanitarian conditions.
We'll now go ahead and move over to Roya to give us what's trending on social media.
Thank you, Caitlin, and welcome, everyone. As you all know, in an unprecedented development that's making waves across international legal and political spheres, the International Criminal Court is reportedly preparing arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former War Minister Yoav Gallant. Today, we're diving deep into this complex situation. Political responses to this step by the ICC are increasing by the day. The Irish politician and former member of European Parliament, Claire Daly, stressed that holding war criminals accountable is not specific to Netanyahu and Gallant alone.
Two people criminally responsible is definitely not the case. This needs to go all the way to the tops of the US administration and to the European Union elites who have enabled and ensured that this genocide has continued. It couldn't have happened without them. It wouldn't have even started without them. Israel is finished after this. They have nowhere else to go. And it may not seem like that because, you know, the EU and the US have their backs at the moment. But I firmly believe that this is this generation's Vietnam. Things will never be the same after this. And a whole layer of young people and people who are older who never paid attention to this issue are not going to let it go until there is justice for Palestine. Like the movement that is on the streets has to be toughened up. The BDS, the whole isolation of Israel.
As always, Claire Daly captivates the audience with her words. Now let's look at how social media is responding to these developments. First off, we have a comment by the official page of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, urging the prosecution of all the political and military officials of the terrorist Israeli regime over its atrocities. The comment posted in Hebrew says, all the political and military captains of the criminal Zionist terrorist gang must be prosecuted. Moving on to the next comment that we have, it is by British activist Owen Jones saying, this is the behavior of a rogue state. Germany is a member state of the International Criminal Court. It is legally bound to accept its jurisdiction. Western states are determined to trash what remains of the international order to protect Israel as it commits genocide. So this comment is because Germany is suggesting that it will not go ahead with the arrest warrants. Well, as the Israeli regime rushed out the condemnation of the ICC, accusing it of being anti-Semitic, many human rights lawyers assured that nothing of the ICC arrest warrants has to do with anti-Semitism. One of them is Jeffrey Robertson, a prominent human rights lawyer. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
I think it is not impossible if he fell from power.
So the most likely people to hand him over would be the Israelis themselves rather than him getting arrested on the streets of London or Paris.
It would be an easy way of disposing of him to, were he to fail at the next elections, sent off to defend himself. But that's not likely. The likelihood is there'll be enormous American pressure to protect him, and we'll just have to wait and hope to see this court showing its independence. It's not anti-Semitic. That's an outrageous lie by Israel. There's nothing anti-Semitic about it. We can see on our television the war crimes every night as residential.
That was Jeffrey Robertson. Let's go back to reactions on social media. And this time we're going to look at what's happening on Facebook. We have more comments there. The first comment we're going to read is by Sammy Wosley. He says, "All countries that respect human rights and international law must cease cooperation and sever relations with this country whose government is led by a war criminal wanted by the courts." That was the first comment. And the last comment we have for today is by Josh Lowe, saying, "The West is worried. The court they built to stop people they don't like has now started seeing what is actually the truth. And it's the West that is the issue and threat to the world." So he's saying that the reason the West is reacting this way is because it's worried about the truth being exposed. Well, as we follow these reactions after the ICC warrants, we find that most of the reactions call for a full commitment to hold the war criminals accountable. Because this isn't just about international law and its application. It's also about stopping the genocide that is taking place in Gaza. Back to you, Caitlin.
Well, thank you very much, Roya, for those updates on what's trending on social media. A gunman was killed and three security officers were injured in a shooting incident near the Israeli embassy in the Jordanian capital. Zaid Akarba reports from Amman.
Early on Sunday, Jordanians woke up to a shooting near the Israeli embassy in Amman. According to an official government statement, the shooter exchanged fire with security forces, injuring three officers. He was subsequently killed. Political analysts have linked the incident to the significance of the location, which has been the site of year-long protests involving thousands of Jordanians calling on the Jordanian government to close the Israeli embassy.
What happened this morning is an unacceptable attack in every sense. We oppose it politically, and we assert that the presence of this embassy, if the incident was indeed related to it, does not justify the assault on the public security forces. These officers are our sons, and they represent the decisions made by political forces, the government, and parliament. As the Popular Unity Party, as political figures, and as political parties, we view the public security forces as the Jordanian forces. They must not be challenged or confronted. The international community and global organizations must exert pressure on Israel to halt its genocidal war.
Jordan's leftist parties attributed the incident to escalating tensions over events in Gaza and called for urgent regional and international action to end the war.
I believe that what occurred today in front of the Israeli embassy in Amman cannot be viewed in isolation from the criminal war. Israel is waging against the people in Gaza and Lebanon. This Zionist entity is conducting a campaign of genocide. The emotional, political, and future repercussions of this genocide are felt across all Arab and Muslim nations, as well as by all free people around the world.
It's important to note that the Israeli embassy in Amman has been closed for over a year after the start of Israel's war on Gaza in early October last year. This led to Jordan recalling its ambassador from Israel and not allowing the return of Israel's ambassador who had previously left the kingdom. As these developments unfold, calls are growing to bring an end to the genocidal war on Gaza and to ensure regional stability. Jordanians are highlighting the importance of taking decisive action to support the Palestinian cause and work towards a just peace. Zaid Agarbe, Amman.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the members of the sixth session of the Assembly of Experts of the Leadership. The meeting took place in Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on November 7th, 2024. What I want to emphasize is that these acts of jihad, which praise God are continuing with strength and power in Lebanon, Gaza and Palestine today, will definitely lead to the victory of truth, the victory of the front of truth, and the victory of the resistance front. This is what we hope for, and based on what we know from overall events, and also from what God has promised, we believe this outcome is certain. First of all, we know this is certain because of God's promise. A perfect example of this noble verse are the events that are taking place these days. Those who are fought against are permitted to fight because they have been wronged, and Allah is indeed able to help them. Those who were expelled from their homes unjustly, only because they said, "Allah is our Lord."
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Had not Allah repelled some people by means of others, ruin would have befallen the monasteries, churches, synagogues, and mosques in which Allah's name is remembered much. The Holy Quran, chapter 29, verses 39 and 40. They bomb churches, they bomb hospitals, and they bomb mosques. It's truly an exact example of this verse. This repelling some people by means of others exists. What's the outcome of this? The outcome is stated in the continuation of the same verse. Allah will surely help those who help him. Indeed, Allah is strong and mighty. Holy Quran, chapter 22, verse 40. And there is an emphasis in this verse. This repelling some people by means of others means repelling the oppressor by the oppressed, and also repelling the aggressor and invader by way of the jihad of those who fight on the path of God. The result of this is, and Allah will surely help those who help him. This is a divine promise. It is, a statement from God, and there is no room for doubt about this. It is not permissible to doubt God's promise. This is a promise that Almighty God has made, and this is the way things have happened until now.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
A window to Palestine.
Well, we are back, and today we wanted to make an exception to what we had been doing in all programs where we invited someone from the Palestinian diaspora to learn more about the Palestinian diaspora in Chile. Today we wanted to invite a visual artist, a muralist, an outstanding Chilean artist. I cannot say of all time, because he is not that old, but he has a career known to all. With us is Alejandro González, Mono González, a member of the Communist Party, one of the founders of the mythical Ramona Parra Brigade, and perhaps one of the most famous artists in our country today. I invite you to watch the following video to learn a little bit more about Mono González.
Video para conocer un poco más del Mono González.
Mono González has painted in more than 30 countries. He is a painter, muralist, engraver, poster artist, screen printer, and above all, he's an art worker, as he defines himself. Known internationally as the creator of muralist brigades, Ramona Parra Brigade, which with his particular style were the visible face of Salvador Allende governments, he is today without a doubt the living plastic artist most recognized and loved by the Chilean people. Since his beginning in the art world, González had a special concern for social issues and conflicts outside national borders. This is how at the end of the 60s he was part of the Great March Against the Vietnam War, which united the cities of Valparaíso and Santiago, a 130-kilometer march that brought together the youth of the time against imperialism and for the defense of life. Since October of last year, he has designed and financed the printing of thousands of posters to raise awareness about the massacre in Palestine and to call for mobilization so that concrete actions are taken across the country to stop and isolate the aggressors. González firmly believes that the pain and injustices that are committed in any part of the world are not foreign to them, and that the fights for a better world are also their fights. He believes that it is impossible to sit back and do nothing if they do not feel the same. The future will hold us accountable for what happens today. It is our fault to let them destroy not only the trees, but also the sprouts.
Well, thank you very much, Mono, for accepting this invitation. For us, it was very important to have you here today to finish this first season of A Window to Palestine. The first thing I would like to ask you is, how did this commitment to the causes of the people who fight for their freedom and justice around the world come about, and why? Because you have traveled the entire world and have participated in these struggles with your art. Where does this come from?
¿De dónde nace esto?
De la militancia.
It comes from militancy. First of all, a sense of social conscience was found within me because I come from the lower ranks of the society. I mean, I was the son of a simple worker, the son of a peasant. So, therefore, in some way, I come from a harsh reality. I was also grown up with sensitivity that is creation, and all these helped me gain knowledge and that social consciousness I mentioned earlier.
At what age did you start military?
Nací militando.
I was born as a soldier. I'm the son of a communist. Even my father, he knew Elias Laferte. When my father was young, he was relegated a year on Easter Island with Elias Laferte. But I don't know in what period. And then, well, I was born in 1947 in the midst of illegality during the presidency of González Videla. So, therefore, I was born within these ups and downs or military adventurism. We were born in problems.
You were also born in the midst of secrecies.
Exactly, and we also had to live a part of our lives in secret.
How have you felt these last few months where, for the first time in the history of humanity, we are experiencing a genocide? But were the victims of this genocide themselves filming themselves before being murdered and share these images around the world?
Well, while there is information that is seen, there is also information that is hidden. Deep down, what we did and what we want to do and intend to do as an art worker is to make visible what is hidden. For example, this last poster we made, of which more than 1,000 have been posted these nights, this poster cries out about the children who are being massacred. And now these children are watching us from the city walls. So deep down, it is also a kind of denunciation and testimony, and it brings awareness to the society, because sometimes we forget the pain of the Palestinians as if it is not happening. So this art is actually leaving that effect on people. In recent months, these paintings and artworks have us stuck together like they're joining hands, like militants, as if they're striving to remain on the walls and resist. In fact, these paintings communicate with people while they also preserve their artistic aspects. We are talking about a wake-up call which denounces the invasion or the beginning of the war, and today, deep down, we owe this presence to such learnings.
This speaks without a doubt of a committed art, and I do not see that this is, in quotes, the general rule. It happens to me a bit like what happened in the October Revolt here in Chile, where the artists arrived late. They got on after everything had started, and indeed, in one way or another, they tried to join in, but if one looks at what is happening now, it seems that art today is more reluctant to political commitment, to social commitment, to commitment to popular causes, and that this committed art is either on the verge of extinction or has effectively stopped to be part of raising awareness.
There is something super important here that also has to do with education or the curricular framework for teaching and the visual arts. I remember, for example, in Allende's campaign, the visual artists were, even before forming the Popular Unity Committee, they made exhibitions, they made the list of the first 40 measures, they made all over the world, they made the struggle as a culture museum in the Allende government. These are the records. But today, it is not that it is in decline, but that it has been neutralized through the curricular frameworks, that is, our artists. So, therefore, generally speaking, many times it is strange that, for example, we are on the street making posters, and then we are also present in art galleries, or we are traveling, let's say, to museums. So it's like we're making a precedent again. It is an action of art, of denunciation, and of testimony and perseverance. So deep down, it is that. And it is strong in that sense, because I, for example, have made the entire record of this design process, and it is going to be part of many classes that I'm going to start teaching in schools, especially in universities, where they study graphic design. That's because today the graphic designers are trained to provide a service for consumption, for that type of things, and their works have less connection with the social sphere. Deep down, we are going back to rescue this cry in the streets through the political posters. I mean, that's basically what it is. In other words, we're trying to bring life back to this type of art. We're not only denouncing it, but we also leave a record for these students to say, look, here we have to nourish, and here we have to go out, here we have to be on the streets, because things are happening that often seem like they don't happen or that will never happen to us, but they have happened to us. In the dictatorship, we have missing detainees. Justice has been missing throughout our history. So deep down, the justice is still present. There is a common story.
This year we commemorate the 60th anniversary of the coup in Brazil, but also the 50 years of the Carnation Revolution in Portugal. And last year we commemorated the 50th anniversary of the coup that took place here. Things don't just happen in one place. They are international. What is happening out there can also happen here. And you have to report it and you have to be consistent.
Have you had a response within the artistic community?
Yes, from graphic designers, especially from the professors of teachers. But they don't commit. They don't make it public. That's because at the end of the day, they're also tied as teachers within the universities in the colonial mesh. So they're bound to those commitments, but I'm free. So therefore, I have no problem.
It seems that neoliberalism has managed to mutate several professions at the center of universities. Before, art was about denunciation, it was about protest. Before, journalism tried to communicate what bothered power. And it seems that today, art is concerned with producing only what sells, and therefore today, we have journalists and artists that help those in power and serve to reduce wealth.
Brother, there's a very important thing that must be said. There are different ways. One way for the dictatorship is eliminating detainees, silencing and extinguishing these figures that scream for justice. And the other way is also to neutralize the intellectuals. And deep down, this journalism, this truth, or this justice has been neutralized, as have the artists. Artists are thinking about success. They're thinking about winning prizes or being famous. We're not thinking about that. We're thinking about this cause. In other words, we do territory work. Deep down, we are also recording that. And to me, it is very important for this age, at least, to teach young people, look, this justice is still possible. To the extent that we record it, this poster is going to be in a museum. This poster was released. Today, you can print it anywhere in the world. I mean, this is what we are doing. This fight is not for one. It is for everyone. We're speaking in plural.
I want to show the poster now, and I want you... Wait, okay. I put it here so that the viewers have a perfect view of the poster on the camera. I would like to ask you to tell us a little about this poster.
Let's see, we made another poster. It was more BRP. It was more street type. It was more like very territorial of here, of our heritage, than what we are used to, or the young people are used to. And suddenly, we thought that we have to make a poster that is for all parts of the world. In fact, the text is written in such a way that it can be read everywhere. Secondly, we start from photos and records of these children who are under the demolitions from the cement, from that gray dust.
This poster was made in the last few days and is already posted.
This is another super important point. The process takes us more than a week. We design it, we print it, it's offset printed. It is not common to print this size due to high costs and shortage of machinery. The machinery are almost exhausted and left aside. But we did our best. We followed the process of the pictures that are put up in the streets for recitals, for concerts, because the audience that goes to these concerts, to recitals, are the young generation. So we said, okay, let's go get that street support. Gather it and address the costs. Paper purchases. In other words, we get the funds and buy paper. But also in the design of this story, we worked hard because these images of the children, my grandson, for example, seeing those images, he burst into tears. Oh, and one more important point. Look, this poster is 1 meter high. That is, if we put up two rows of these posters, it'll be 2 meters high. What more can anyone do? I mean, pay attention to the number of the children who are going to be on this wall watching and denouncing. It is incredible. In other words, it is the presence of these children on the streets that matters. It has to do with communication, but it has also to do with the colors of Palestine. That is, black, white, green, red, etc. We didn't want to add the blood. We didn't want to add anything, but just pay attention to the look that you see in these children there, for example. They're alive.
What message would you send to the visual artists of the world? Because one is left with the feeling that there is still little of this exercise that had helped so much in other tragic moments in history to defeat fascism, Nazism, and today, Zionism.
It also has a lot to do with culture, with what I was talking about, how they neutralize things. That is, young people, for example, who paint graffiti or murals. I work a lot with young people and also with artists. In other words, suddenly they're like holding hands for their survival. But then, fortunately, they're observed by the systems. But what we have installed here, the interesting thing is that this has been generated with donations. It has been generated with a territory where many people participate. People from the printing press, people from the vehicles, people from the stickers, I mean those who stick these posters on the walls, people from the designers, from the digital. In other words, you don't work alone. You work as a team. We do not work in that individualism that the neoliberal system encourages so much, but rather we work collectively. That's why I always speak in the plural. And here we are speaking in plural because it is not a child. It is all children. So that's what we are talking about.
Well, Mono, I thank you not only for the painting, which is a fundamental contribution, but also for rescuing something that stopped being discussed a long time ago, and that is the fundamental importance that art has in the future of people. Nowadays, art seems to be a little left aside, too. It has been crushed by the market, and this is a demonstration that there is still much to do with art to improve the world in which we live.
De que todavía queda mucho por hacer con el arte para mejorar el mundo que vive.
No, y decirle a los jóvenes que es posible.
We should tell the young generation what is possible and what needs to be done. This is like art. I don't want to mention names here as it's a collective work, but street, territory, presence. What do we see on the street? The invasion on the street, which is also a fight to win space, which is occupying public space and giving meaning to that public space. So they started the fight to remove the statue of Manuel Baquedano until they did it. It wasn't the horse, it was the symbol. What are the monuments that are in the streets? They are the monuments of power. Ultimately, what we are doing with the poster is making this massacre visible. We put in the peripheral vision of the world what they are trying to hide. I mean, we are alive. Here is another important thing, the self-esteem. I mean, to all the neighbors, to the people who are seeing this, it's like, look at the time of the dictatorship. In the middle of the dictatorship, if someone, even if they were illiterate, didn't know how to draw, they would use the fingerprints of the detainees who disappeared or something. The detainees who were raising their voices, although it was not well made, although it was not pretty, but it was present. In other words, it was possible to make them alive. That's what's important. This is the same. I mean, all these children, imagine if they are released at this moment, if they are printed in all parts of the world, on the walls of the world, stuck in the streets, these children will be watching. I mean, it also has to do with poetry. It also has to do with creation. It also has to do with sensitivity, but it also has to do with something that is super important. How do we give this contemporaneity to art? I mean, I've not been doing murals for 50, 60 or 70 years. We are in today. This was told to me by a person who was an exhibition curator. In the exhibitions, there are frames and pictures on the walls. You can frame them, place them there, but when it comes to the streets, it is different. The posters on the streets are events and they fulfill social functions. It is social art.
Es un arte social.
Thank you very much, Alejandro, for accepting this invitation. And thank you for your art and for the relationship it has with the history of the Chilean people, but also with the history of the peoples of the world. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back. It is what you do, not what you say. Today, Palestine is a prisoner of two realities that it is almost impossible for them to talk about. On the one hand, a kind of collective schizophrenia of Zionism that despite being a country with one of the best armies in the world, which can destroy whatever it wants, which can murder whoever it wants inside and outside of Israel, which enjoys all the impunity granted by the European powers, by the United States, by Canada, but also enjoying all the immunity of the United Nations Security Council, is presented to the entire world as the victim. That is, the butchers disguised as lambs of peace. On the other hand, there are the Palestinians, who have been listening for years what we have been seeing in these videos. Statements full of content about the rights of the Palestinian people, about the two-state solution, but changes have been consolidated in the territory that make this possibility a bad joke. The Palestinians live in learned hopelessness. They no longer believe in anything. They do not believe in anyone. And they do not believe that anything that may happen in the future is going to improve their lives and give them the most basic rights as all human beings on the face of the earth. In that context, talking today about the two-state solution is painful, as it should have emerged 75 years ago when Palestine was divided. But that could only see the birth of only one. Nobody accepted the partition. The Zionists, who had benefited without asking the Palestinians, took 80% of the land of historic Palestine with 56% of the territory. And from there, they began with a macabre plan concocted from the beginning to expel the Palestinians from all their land and end up taking over all the Palestinian territory. If this continues today in Gaza, the next step will be the West Bank. Again, before the astonished gaze of an international community that is absolutely impotent and complicit for being unable to stop a genocidal regime. Today, it is necessary to reflect deeply again on the true options for peace. The changes in the territory, the impunity towards the regime of Israel, the indolence of the West, the perverse arms business making Israel feel completely powerful to carry out its projects that does not end in Palestine. If this does not change, the only possibility is to be much more radical. But being radical does not mean continuing to kill ourselves for being different. Being radical today means once and for all learning to see each other as equals, as before the arrival of Zionism in Palestine, when in that small territory, Jews, Christians, Muslims, and atheists lived together in perfect harmony, because no one felt they were in possession of either a divine project or the absolute truth or the possibility of exterminating everyone around them. Peace is the only possibility, but for that, looking at ourselves as equals and assuming that all human beings have the same rights that one considers they have is fundamental. You're now going to move on to questions from the audience in order to continue analyzing the very elusive possibilities that we see today for peace in Palestine.
In Palestina.
Hola, Daniel.
Hello, Daniel. My name is Lily. I'm a sociologist and activist for the total liberation of the Palestinian people. I wanted to ask you about something that has been discussed a lot lately in the media and on social networks, and it is about the two-state solution. I wanted to first ask you if you could explain a little more to us what this is, and then I would like to know what you personally think about it.
Let's see. The two-state solution has been on the table since 1947, following the partition of Palestine. However, from the beginning, neither party accepted the partition. The Zionists, who, in quotes, were supposed to keep 56% of historic Palestine, took over 78% of the territory and expelled more than 1 million Palestinians, razing more than 500 villages with a plan that they had previously designed in detail, which was the Dalay plan. Therefore, from the beginning, the lack of willingness of Zionism as a political project to accept the existence of a Palestinian state was made explicit. And finally, the Palestinians, for their part, did not accept the partition because they had not been consulted. This always reminds me of the biblical episode of Solomon, when the two women arrive saying that they were both mothers of a baby, and that Solomon, in a Solomonic solution, tells them, "Divide the baby in half." And one of the women accepts the partition, which meant the death of the baby, but the other woman says no. She accepts to give up the baby to her so that the baby can live. And Solomon, with great wisdom, takes the baby and gives it to that woman who had rejected the partition because it denoted her attitude, that she was the true mother. The other was willing to kill the baby to keep half of it, but she wasn't. It was absolutely obvious to the Palestinians that they would never accept partition because their land was being stolen without them ever being consulted. From then on, Zionism advanced. Its expansion started first from the territories occupied in the 1967 war, then the Golan Heights, Lebanon, and when one looks at the historical project of Zionism, it speaks of Eretz Yisrael, from the Nile to the Euphrates, which is also the meaning of the flag with the Star of David between the two most important river channels in the area. Therefore, one can perceive that the Zionist project goes much further, and when one hears statements like the statements we saw in the video, one realizes that they also feel like a chosen people, They have a supremacist zeal. They believe that others have no right to exist and remain anchored to a biblical mandate that called them to end the life of everything that existed on that territory. And there are some religious fanatics who still believe in writing of this type, which has also been tremendously distorted and transformed into a project that has nothing to do with the coming of the Messiah, nor with the second coming of Christ. In the last agreement that was signed, where the two states appeared as a possibility, there were several points that were essential. First, reducing the obstacles to the freedom of movement of Palestinians in the occupied territories. Reduce, dismantle, and avoid further construction of illegal settlements in the occupied territories. And the construction of a state that had to be born within a maximum period of 5 years. What we can say, 30 years after that agreement and after the assassination at the hands of an Israeli terrorist of the Israeli prime minister who signed that agreement, is that the obstacle to freedom of movement have multiplied almost tenfold, that illegal settlements have grown sevenfold, and that a security ring of illegal Israeli settlers has ended up forming around Jerusalem Al-Quds, which has always been considered the capital of both parts. With all of this, in addition to the division into sectors A, B, and C, where only territories A have sovereignty, the administrative sovereignty of the Palestinians would be less than 18% of the original territory of Palestine, which is made up of Batustanis and also subdivided by the Wall of Infamy, which the International Court of Justice has defined as illegal. Given this background, one could ask what possibility there is of thinking about both states. Here, I believe that perhaps the mistake of the Palestinian leadership lies in signing an agreement without taking into consideration the logic of its adversary, the psychology of the adversary. Zionism has never told the truth. It has never acted with humanity and honesty. It has always lied to everyone and has educated the children of Israel to deeply hate the Palestinian people, so much so that by the time an agreement has been made, they have come to think that they are not human beings and that they are inferior. Can we think of peaceful coexistence with a state that has educated its citizens like this? For this reason, as it was the original plan of the PLO, the peace plan for the Palestinians has been a single plurinational state for anyone who wanted to live in and fight in a territory where there was no discrimination based on race, color, or religion. This is a fundamental letter of the PLO, and it is what has been put back on the table today when what happened in the territory and what happened with the hypocrisy of the United States and Europe have made any possibility of two states disappear. Well, this is too much change for the Israeli society, because furthermore, when faced with a question like yours, I could not say in what language, which is the house of being, do we speak? In the language of Zionism or in the language of the Palestinians? If we spoke in the language of Zionism, which is unacceptable, we would say in Israel there are no innocent civilians. If we spoke in the language of Zionism, we would say if what happened after October the 7th is justified by what happened on October the 7th, then everything that happened before October the 7th would justify the October 7th attack. This is not the way. The only possibility is to dare to see each other as equals, to dare to live together in absolute equality of duties and rights in a territory that has always welcomed all peoples who, regardless of their interest, intended to control the world. All of them have passed through Palestine, inhabited Palestine, and then left. What is clear is that the Palestinians were there before the first invader arrived, and they will surely be there after the last one leaves. Thanks, Lily.
Hello, Daniel. I'm Manuel Hidalgo, leader of IMA, the International Migrants Alliance, a network of grassroots migrant and refugee organizations worldwide, and the National Immigrant Coordination, which we also deeply sympathize with the struggle of the Palestinian people. I want to ask you, what are the reasons? Why have you become immigrants? What are the conditions to achieve peace in Palestine? And what role does the international community have in this objective?
Manuel, your question is tremendously interesting, but also very complex, because it forces us to address the Middle East conflict as part of a global North-South conflict that is on a global scale. Transnational capital, when it is in times of contraction of its rate of profit, according to Marx, is dedicated to destroying productive factors in such a way as to also put an end to any obstacle that allows it to take over all the markets, all the natural resources, and everything that can allow them to continue the process of accumulation and concentration of wealth. Therefore, one has to understand the question of Palestine in a global framework that also explains the non-escalating war, which explains the intervention in various Latin American countries where transnational capital tries to overthrow governments that seek an autonomous alternative and be owners of their own resources. And in that context, what one should look at as a basic condition is that a world that does not have to go from being unipolar to multipolar is truly established. It has to go from being unipolar to multilateral. That is, a world where there are no poles of development that live at the expense of impoverishing the rest of the world, but rather there is truly a world where all states are peers, have the same rights and the same duties towards the international community. Of course, when one focuses on the West Asia, this requires recognizing all the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people, which include the right to return and to self-determination, which is the first collective right of peoples recognized by the United Nations. The same United Nations that in 1947, along with establishing that right, is the first to violate it when it divides Palestine without consulting the Palestinians. But in addition to the rights of return and self-determination, there is the inalienable rights of the establishment of a Palestinian state in Palestine with Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital. These are inalienable national rights. The only thing the Palestinian people want is to live in peace. It has never moved outside its territory to invade any nation on the planet. It has never expelled from Palestine anyone who came to ask for shelter and solidarity. Zionism came to destroy the Palestinian people and to deprive them of all their ancestral rights. I want to thank the entire production team for the wonderful work that they have done on this first season. I invite you to meet us in the second season of A Window to Palestine.
Ventana a Palestina.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment. Allah, Allah,
Allah, Allah, Allah. این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from iranradio.ir. Well, in this program, what we do is to talk about some of the viewpoints and sentences of Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi, who was the great founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and then try to shed light and talk about some of the points in these statements. Well, about conceit in ulama, Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi says, "The unfortunate alim who is defeated by his own conceit cannot reform himself or his community, and it will result in nothing but harm to Islam and the Muslims." Here Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is talking about the danger of self-praise for a religious scholar. Conceit stands for self-importance for a good trait or a noble quality such as knowledge, wealth, high rank or righteous deed. Conceit causes selfishness and vanity, which are the causes of people's detestation and humiliation. It turns one's eyes away from noticing his own defects. The conceited forgets He sins and causes himself many damages. Sin's negligence of sins stops against repentance to God and exposes to his wrath. Unfortunately, when it comes to the ulama, conceit and self-praise becomes so dangerous because as an alim or religious scholar starts to praise himself, he considers himself to be the superior to others and treats others as imperfect and insignificant beings. He views them disdainfully in his heart and treats them with contempt. He excludes every individual from divine grace and mercy and considers them a right belonging to himself or to some people like him. The person who has reached this stage comes to a point when he denies whatever virtues he received in others and is disposed to regard its presence in others as disputable.
صلى الله عليه
صل
يا رسول الله
يا ربنا صل على طه النبي وآله.
Somehow, he suspects the sincerity of their virtues in his heart and considers his own deeds as free from any kind of fault. He underrates others' good deeds, but if he himself performs those deeds, he magnifies them. He is sensitive to others' errors, but overlooks his own faults. In his Al-Khisal, Shaykh Al-Saduq reports from Imam Al-Sadiq alayhi salam that he said, "The devil says, if I subdue the son of Adam in three things, I do not care for whatever he may do, as his good deeds will not be accepted. First, when he overestimates his good deeds. Two, when he is forgetful about his sins. And three, when urge permits him." That is why Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh warns every Muslim, and especially the ulama, to keep themselves from the trips of the doomed Satan. May Allah guide us all to his right path. Okay, well, dear listeners, that was the time we had for this episode of Spring of the Truth. For ending, let me just recite the sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh about conceit in ulama. He said, "The unfortunate alim who is defeated by his own conceit cannot reform himself or his community, and it will result in nothing but harm to Islam and to Muslims." Thank you very much for listening to us. Until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be highlighting how a pro-Palestinian hacking group penetrated Israel's military computer systems and accessed sensitive military intelligence and embarrassing personal information. In our first report, Latifa Abouchakra summarises the extent of the hacking operation.
The revenge of Palestinian refugee boy Handala has come. A hacker group believed to be linked to the Islamic Republic of Iran and carrying the name of Palestinian cartoonist Naji Ali's iconic symbol, Handala, has struck deep into Israeli military infrastructure. Naji Ali, the rebellious Palestinian cartoonist who was assassinated by Palestinian traitors working for Israeli intelligence on the streets of London, could never have dreamed that his innovative creation, Handala, would carry such a legacy. Handala was the refugee boy who refused to turn around and show his face until return was achieved. The Handala hackers released around 30 images taken from Israel's top-secret Sorek Nuclear Research Center. The group also released the details of an Israeli nuclear scientist for the first time. Her picture was released for the world to see. Handala previously hacked Israel's Negev Nuclear Research Center and threatened to publish its full cache of documents. They also hacked the phone of Major General Gadi Eisenkot, former chief of staff of the Israeli occupation forces and founder of Israel's cybersecurity command. The images, which seem to have been taken from his personal phone, reveal him naked in a bathtub. Eisenkot lost his son, Gal, earlier in the genocide when he was working for the Israeli military in Gaza. Now it seems that Handala has taken his dignity too. Most dramatically, Handala released scandalous images of Israel's former defense minister, Benny Gantz, in the midst of his affair with Netanyahu's personal physician. The hack revealed not only that the physician provided Gantz with secret information about Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, but also that Gantz's daughter killed herself when she was made aware of her father's infidelity. It seems that the attempt to destroy Palestine and Lebanon is having a direct effect on the personal lives of Israeli leaders. The downward spiral of the Zionist project continues, and one day soon,